Whenever a member of the Quorum of the Twelve is present, he's in charge of this assembly. And I have been requested by Brother Benson this morning, before he speaks, to take just a few moments of your time. I think that probably when I get through, he'll be sorry, but I'm going to do it anyway. Let me very hurriedly sketch some of the history of the church in the nation's capital. In 1839, the prophet Joseph Smith, with Judge Higbee, went to Washington to try to secure a redress of the grievances of the saints for the wrongs that had been inflicted upon them in the state of Missouri. They traveled by stagecoach the last part of the journey. When they were just out of Washington, D.C., a short distance, the driver drove up to a tavern and left the stagecoach and the horses unattended, and they became frightened and a runaway occurred. The Prophet Joseph and the other occupants were still in the stagecoach. A mother, becoming alarmed, immediately threatened to throw her babe out of the window. The Prophet restrained her, and with the physical dexterity of which he was, which was inherent in him, he managed to break the window of the stagecoach, climb up the side, and obtain the reins and brought the horses to a stop. He found out then that two of the occupants of the stagecoach were congressmen, and they were so gratified at this act of heroism that they proposed the moment they got to Washington that they would have the House of Representatives pass a resolution for a Congressional Medal of Honor for his heroism. And then they asked him his name, and he told him that he was Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet. And the prophet records that he heard no more about any congressional medal. He went to Washington, appeared before the committees of the House and the Senate in favor of a redress of these grievances. He got nowhere. He called on Martin Van Buren, the president. President Van Buren listened attentively, but told him that while his cause was just, he could do nothing for him because he would lose the votes of the state of Missouri. The prophet was quite disillusioned about politicians in general, and before leaving Washington, he uttered a vigorous condemnation of them. Later, you'll recall that he proposed that senators and members of the House secure only $2 a day for their compensation. But in leaving Washington also, and that's the important thing that I have to say to you this morning, he said that the time would come when the saints would be respected in the nation's capital, and they would be sought out and looked to for leadership. That was in 1839. Now let's skip a period of about 63 years. In 1902, the state legislature elected a young man of only 39 years of age to be Senator of the United States. I should say that when the prophet went to the Capitol, he was only 34. This young man, elected by the state legislature, was an alumnus of this institution, a resident of Provo, Senator Reed Smoot. Hearings there in Washington continued then for some 3 years to determine whether the Senate would seat him. And while there was no specific charge against him, partisanship was still rampant in Washington against the Mormons, particularly because of the fact that the church had at one time practiced polygamy. Mr. George Sutherland, later Justice of the Supreme Court, a non-Mormon, also an alumnus of this institution, was his counsel. The most learned statement made in his behalf was made by Dr. James E. Talmage, then a member of the faculty of this school, later a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. And after 3 years, they decided to vote as to whether Reed Smoot would be seated in the Senate. The night before, one of the senators who had a reputation for philandering called upon a senator from Pennsylvania and asked him to vote against Senator Smoot. The senator listened intently and asked him if Smoot was a polygamist. The answer, of course, was no. And then this senator from Pennsylvania said, knowing of the reputation of the other senator, "I'm going to vote for Smoot because I would very much prefer to have in the Senate a polygamist who doesn't polyg than a monogamist who doesn't monog." And the next day, Senator Smoot was seated. During his 30 years in the Senate, Senator Smoot became in many respects the most powerful man in Washington. Because of his industry, he knew more about government than any other man in the Congress. And I know from having been there that members of both parties would seek him out to find out what the facts were with respect to different departments of the government. He brought scores of young Utahns to Washington, where they studied medicine, law, government, and began their careers. At one time, there were more law students there in George Washington University from Utah, despite its size, than any state in the Union, with the exception of the state of Pennsylvania. Some of us didn't always agree with Senator Smoot politically, but we always respected his great capacity for industry, his integrity, and his devotion to his work. And now let me skip from 1902 to 1939. In 1939, you'll note, is just 100 years from the time that the Prophet Joseph came to the Capitol. In that year, another young man, just 39 years of age, came to Washington. He came there at the request of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, which represents nearly all of the farm cooperatives in this country. At one time, it represented, I recall, the farmer cooperatives of 98% of all the counties in the country. This young man came there to be interviewed for the top position, top executive of that organization. He came without having made any application, but he was sought after. He appeared before the board of directors, board of trustees of that great national organization. And after answering a number of questions, the chairman of that committee, who was a distinguished judge from Pennsylvania by the name of Judge Miller, turned to him and asked him if he would accept the position as executive secretary of that organization. And this young man, Ezra Taft Benson, then president of the Boise State, told them that he did not think he would accept, that he had found out that when you are the top executive of many of these organizations in Washington, you're supposed to do a lot of lobbying. And he found out that almost inherent in the situation that they did a lot of entertaining and having cocktail parties. And he was not going to accept any job in which he would be criticized if he didn't do that, because he never intended to do it. And Judge Miller, this white-haired, venerable leader, turned to him and said, "Mr. Benson, that's why we've selected you. We know you're a Mormon. We know what your standards are. We know that you keep those standards. And we don't want the lobbying activities of this organization carried on in the way they're generally carried on. And if you come here, you won't have to do that. And not only that, we hope you won't do it." And under those conditions, Elder Benson changed his mind and accepted the position as the top executive of this national organization. During the 4 years he served in that capacity, it was my privilege to serve as general counsel of that organization, so I know intimately his activities. After he'd been there less than a year, he was also called as president of the Washington State. Immediately being on call to that position, I noticed his ability to rise above petty partisanship and the opinions of individuals. For knowing that I had recommended someone else as stake president, he sought me out as his counselor, and in order to be entirely frank, I told him that I had recommended someone else, and he turned to me and he said, "That's just the reason I want you. I admire your judgment." During the time that he was president of the stake, he made a trip west. While he was west, one of the members of the quorum passed on. In his absence, we held a stake presidency meeting, and he had been so humble in his leadership and so effective that in our stake presidency meeting, before the announcement of his appointment was ever made, before it was decided upon, I remember the clerk of our stake, a bishop who has a daughter here at this school, saying in our presidency meeting that he was sure, from a feeling that he had, that before Brother Benson came back, he would be a member of the Quorum of the Twelve. That's what we thought of him there. He became, during that time, one of the great agriculture leaders in Washington, became respected, honored by all those interested in agriculture. His appointment is hailed throughout the country by all farm leaders who place their love for the Constitution and for the freedom of agriculture above the philosophy that farmers should be kept by the government. He did not seek this position. It came as a result of a groundswell on the part of leaders all over the country who have a regard not only for him but also for our Mormon economics and philosophy, that man shall earn his living by the sweat of his own brow. Now, just a word about his personal life. He was born in Whitney, Idaho in 1899, the oldest of 11 children. Became a farmer immediately, for at the age of 4, he was able to drive the team. At his death, his father and grandparents despaired of his life. The doctor thought it would be impossible for him to live. But his father and grandparents then dedicated him to the Lord, and he's been in the service of the Lord ever since. While still in grade school, his father went on a mission, and young Ezra and his younger brothers took charge of the farm and ran it during that time. Later, finishing high school, he managed to get in a few winter quarters at the Utah State Agricultural College. In 1921, went on a mission to Great Britain. On returning, he and his brother purchased a farm for the purpose of obtaining their education, on the understanding that one would go to school one quarter and one the next. And being a returned missionary, and I should tell him that we have now 1,080 of them on the campus, and also having heard of the superior agriculture taught here by Dr. Martin, he repented of his former academic affiliations and enrolled at the BYU. Here he majored in animal husbandry, was voted the most popular man in his class, and graduated in 1926. Later obtained his master's degree at Ames, did further work at the University of California. Marrying after his mission a very faithful girl from Logan, Sister Flora Amason, whom we are delighted to have with us this morning, they now have 6 children. And may I just parenthetically state here that Sister Benson's mother was one of those faithful women who all her life had the promptings of the Spirit. She knew when she was going to pass on, although she was not ill, She told all of her friends and her relatives. And she went out and prepared for her own funeral, purchasing the casket and everything else. And the very night that she had told them she would pass on, she passed on in her sleep. Sister Benson has that same prophetic insight. And even before President Eisenhower called Brother Benson, she told him that morning that President Eisenhower would call him that day. Now, fellow students, let me observe that Utah has had only one man on the Supreme Court. That was George Sutherland, non-Mormon, but a student of Dr. Mazur, a devoted alumnus of this institution. Never before have we had a member of our church serve in the cabinet, and it now falls to another alumnus of this institution to receive that great honor. And I am honored to present to you today a faithful Mormon boy in whose personage the prophecy of the prophet Joseph that our people would someday in Washington be respected and looked to for leadership is now being fulfilled. I'm happy to present our distinguished alumnus, member of the Board of Trustees, Elder Ezra Taft Benson.
I presume we could save a great deal of time if I should pass away now, because we wouldn't need to hold a funeral service. Brother Wilkinson, in addition to all of his other many gifts and virtues, is a prophet, because I do regret that I asked him to speak. But I love him, as I'm sure you do. I have no prepared talk this morning. He assured me that that would not be necessary. But I was just to come here and greet you and look into your faces, get the inspiration which always comes from this experience, and also get away from the pressure which he knows I've been under in the last few days. So it's truly a relief to come here. There are one or two little items I'd like to fill in, if I may. I say I haven't prepared any talk. As a matter of fact, I haven't worried about this appearance. Possibly I should have done. I was out at a state conference some months ago, and I had with me a very fine welfare worker, one of the choice men of this church. But he was very timid. It was very hard for him to speak in conference. And he went to the morning session expected to be called upon, and he wasn't called because there were so many returned missionaries. As we came home to the stake president's home for lunch, he didn't have much of an appetite. It's always easier to speak when you're not overly loaded with food. And so as they passed the food around, he passed the potatoes by. He took just one carrot and practically no meat and nibbled a little at his salad and went to meeting. In fact, he refused some lemon pie that was offered for dessert. And that takes real resistance. Well, after the meeting was over, the mother who had of that home who had a young babe and had to miss the meeting stayed at home, of course, and her son, about 15 years of age, returned from the meeting, and the mother, who had worried about this good welfare worker, said, "Well, how did Brother so-and-so do?" And he said, "Oh, Mom, he just as well a et." Well, I presume it doesn't make much difference whether you worry about it or not. You'll think today that I just as well a et. I have one story I want to tell you. Brother Wilkinson is a very distinguished attorney. I mean that. I wish he were free today. Probably if I didn't love this institution so much, I'd almost insist that he be released to accompany me back to the nation's capital. He's the kind of man I'd like to have as solicitor in the Department of Agriculture. One of the great departments of government, 78,000 employees. But in the presence of Brother Stephen L. Richards the other day, I heard this story. A very fine Christian gentleman, a businessman, was on his deathbed. Knowing that his hours were short, he called in his attorney. He also called in his doctor. And these two distinguished men, seated on either side of his bed, visited with him briefly, and he didn't give them anything of any great importance to consider. And finally, the attorney said, "Why have you invited us here?" And this man said, "For one purpose. I've always been a great admirer of the great teacher, the founder of Christianity. I've always tried to pattern my life after his, and I thought, as I near the end, I'd like to die between two thieves." Well, Brother Wilkinson will forgive me for telling that story, but I learned it from Brother Stephen L. Richards when we were back in Washington together a few days ago. Well, now, my brethren and sisters, it's a great honor to be here this morning. I feel very humble as I look into your faces, and particularly as I contemplate the assignment which has come to me so unexpectedly. I want you to know how deeply grateful I am for all of the influences which have touched my life and have helped to shape my character. I'm grateful for my noble birthright, for my parentage, for the great pioneer stock through which most of us have come. I am grateful I had the privilege of coming to this institution. I am grateful for the spirit that's here, the spirit of the gospel. I am grateful for the men on the faculty who touched my life with their influence. I shall ever be indebted to them. But more than anyone else this morning, I'm grateful to the girl who has been at my side now for 26 years. Brother Wilkinson didn't tell you very much of the part she's played. She's always been an inspiration to me and to our children. And if they ever accomplish anything in life, and we expect them to, she'll be entitled to at least 2/3 of the credit. She's carried more than half the load all the way through. She married a man who was heavily in debt, She knows what it is to live on $70 a month and maintain a home. Coming from a family of some means, she turned her back on all of that and was willing to sacrifice to go out onto the experiment farm at Iowa State College and glean squash from the field and pick nuts in order to cut down the vegetable bill, the food bill. She's been true all the way through. And I pay tribute to her today. No man could ever have a truer companion. You know, it's so common for us men to be in the limelight. We receive the plaudits of men. We're honored. We're commended. But very often, the other part of the team is hardly referred to. I've thought of that a great deal in the last week. Well, now I presume, my brethren and sisters, that you'll be disappointed. Well, I know you're going to be disappointed anyway, but you'll be even more disappointed if I don't tell you something of the rather intimate situation in connection with this call. And if I can do it in just a few words, I'd like to do it for you because I feel so close to this institution. And I hope you'll understand that it isn't done in any spirit of boasting. Since the call has come, I've felt more like praying than anything else. And of course, I've done a great deal of it. And I hope I'll have your faith and prayers. Because this honor is not an honor to an individual member of the church. It's not an honor alone to the Council of the Twelve, the leadership of the church. I look upon it as an honor and a tribute to the church as a whole, an evidence that at last people have come to recognize us for what we are, to recognize our standards, our ideals, our philosophy, the principles for which we stand. And so you share in this honor, and you also share in the responsibility. And to that end, I seek your faith and prayers in the days ahead. Now, it has come as a great surprise. It's true that 4 years ago, I was approached by one of the candidates who expected to be elected, expected with such confidence that I, at least confidence that I had never witnessed in an election. But frankly, the matter had never entered my mind until it was mentioned in a telephone call from Senator Watkins on Thursday night, the 20th of November, in which he asked if I knew that there was developing a great groundswell, he called it, of support for me as secretary. And I said, no, I know nothing about it. And I was truthful. I'd been in Washington a few days before. It had not been mentioned. I was there on church business with Brother Stephen L. Richards. We had had interviews with the Indian Service, the Department of State, General Hersey of Selective Service. We'd participated in the dedication of the Chevy Chase building, but nothing was said about it. And Brother Watkins wanted to know what the attitude of the church would be. I said, there's only one man who can answer that, and that's the president of the church. I don't know what his attitude would be. My life is devoted to this work, but I'd be glad to try and do anything the president of the church asked me to do. The next morning, as I parked my car in the parking lot, I met Brother McKay as he was parking his car. We have a habit of going down rather early in the morning. Very seldom I get there before he does. And he said, I received a very important telephone call last night. And he said, Brother Benson, if the opportunity comes, I think you should accept. I said, Brother McKay, I can't believe it will come. The next day, Brother Mark Peterson and I started for Provo Bench to attend to some business incident to the division of the Sharon Stake. And the call, as my wife had predicted earlier, came and reached me in this city. And when I learned of it, the first place I thought of was the campus of BYU, where I could get by myself in a little office somewhere and quietly consider the matter and talk to the president of the church before I even accepted the call, because they said that the General Eisenhower's office was calling. Well, the call came. It was simply a request to come to Washington for an interview. And frankly, even then, I thought probably they were considering several men, and they wanted a chance to look at some of them whom they were not acquainted with. And I caught the plane that night and went to Washington for the interview. I can say to you frankly, my brethren and sisters, I didn't want to be Secretary of Agriculture. I can't imagine anyone in their sane mind wanting it. Because I know something of what it entails. I know something of the crossfires, the pressures, the problems, the difficulties. Because as Brother Wilkinson has been good enough to indicate, I was rather close to the Department of Agriculture, although not a part of it, while living for 5.5 years in Washington. I've always feared, in a way, getting into politics. I've never had any desire. I've always had a deep interest in seeing men elected to office who represented the ideals and standards which have meant so much to me in my life. But I would always rather support someone else than to actually hold political office. It was with that feeling in mind that I went in to meet for the first time General Eisenhower. And I'm sure he would not object if I told you just briefly what transpired. His brother Milton Eisenhower, whom I had met once, was there. He at one time was in the Department of Agriculture. He was a one-time president of Kansas State College and now is president of Penn State, both of them land-grant colleges. We were together for about 30 minutes. And at the outset, it was made very clear that the decision had been made. There was no one else under consideration. And then I gave 3 or 4 very good reasons why I should not be a member of the cabinet. In the first place, I indicated I'd been a supporter of Senator Taft. Although not an active supporter, I had lent my name to a Citizens for Taft committee. I thought Senator Taft was well qualified. I'd known him in Washington, admired his integrity and his capacity. And I said to the general, it's not because I haven't admired you, but I didn't know you. I'd never seen you till today. And I've always felt it would be a little better, other things being equal, to have a man who was not a military man in the White House. Now, I want you to know that. He said, that's perfectly all right. And I said, the next reason, I come from a state that is usually considered relatively unimportant agriculturally. And even my native state of Idaho is not one of the leading agricultural states. It's always been the custom to select the Secretary of Agriculture from the great farm belt of the Middle West. Well, what's going to be the reaction if you select a man from Utah as Secretary of Agriculture, where we've only got 3% of our land under cultivation? And then thirdly, I said, I know there are several good men in the farm belt who would like to be secretary. And I can support them. At least three of them I could wholeheartedly support. They'd make good secretaries. And they've been working hard for you. And surely you owe them something. And then fourthly, I said, I wonder about the wisdom of calling a clergyman, a minister of the gospel, to be Secretary of Agriculture. What will be the reaction from other religious groups and from people generally? Then he said, suppose we consider the last question first. And then he said, surely you believe that the job at hand is spiritual. Surely you know if we're going to restore confidence in the minds of our people in their own government, that we've got to deal with spiritual matters. And then he went on and answered the rest of them. As he came to the end, he said, we've got a great job to do. I didn't want to be president, frankly, when the pressure started. But he said, you can't refuse to serve America. We've got a job to do, and I want you on my team. Well, my brethren and sisters, no true American could refuse such a request from the president-elect. And so, of course, I accepted. Now, I know that you here today, many of you have supported the governor of Illinois. I know many of you supported Senator Taft and others. And that's perfectly all right. That's our great American privilege. I hope and pray we'll always have freedom of choice. One of the great eternal principles which the God of heaven intends his children to enjoy. But now the American people have spoken. And General Eisenhower is to be inaugurated on January 20th. And on that date he becomes our president. And regardless of our political affiliation, regardless of where our sympathies have laid, it becomes, in my humble judgment, our obligation, our duty, as American citizens, as Latter-day Saints, to give him our faith and prayers, because he'll need them. And so I ask for that support for him, for all the members of the cabinet, and for all of those whom you have elected, you representing the people of the United States, to serve in positions of leadership in this great nation. With that support, with that faith, and with your prayers, we cannot fail. Without that support, we cannot succeed. I know that as I know that I live. I love this great country. I always get a thrill when I go to the nation's capital. I know many people say that's one place they wouldn't live. I loved it in Washington. This may sound almost like treason, but I had no desire to move back west to live. I was so happy there in the work I was doing. I don't know that I'll be so happy again there in this position. But I love all that's associated with Washington. The ideals of our government. The great men who have represented us there. The great statesmen. I get a thrill every time I go into the nation's capital. And on Friday night, when I was there just before we dedicated the Chevy Chase building, I did something I've wanted to do for years. I went into the Capitol and I stood there in the great statuary hall. And I noticed to my great joy, over in one corner, under a lovely light, a statue of the great pioneer Mormon leader, prophet of God, Brigham Young. And I recall that a few years before, while living in Washington, I had gone there frequently, and sometimes would stand there meditating, wondering if the time would ever come when the people of this country would permit Utah to be represented in one of her favored sons. And I remembered one time when, while standing there, that one of the senators came through, as I remember it now, was Senator Ashurst from Arizona. And he greeted me, and I said to him, "Senator, why is it that Utah is not represented here in the Hall of Fame?" And he said, "Why, Mr. Benson, surely you know why." I said, "I think I do, but I'd like to hear it from your lips. You've been a friend of our people." And then he told me that even during his service in the Senate, an effort had been made at one time to get approval from a certain committee for President Brigham Young to represent Utah. And at that time, the prejudice was still in existence, and the committee apparently refused to approve it. But as I stood there on the 20th of this last month, I thrilled as I saw President Brigham Young's likeness there taking his place in the circle among the great. And then I did something I wanted to do. I walked from the Capitol building down straight through the mall on the grass, 2 miles down to the Washington Monument, and then from there on down to the Lincoln Memorial. 1.25 miles from the Capitol to the Washington Monument, 3/4 mile from there on. And as I walked, I reviewed in my own mind the history of this, the greatest nation under heaven. And I hope, my young brethren and sisters, that you will not leave this institution without taking a good course in American history. And I mean that sincerely. I think one of the weaknesses in our educational system today, in many parts, is the fact that students leave the institutions where they get their education without knowing but very little about our American background, the fundamental basic concepts of our American way of life. You may recall, those of you who've been in Washington, that between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, there's what they call a reflecting pool. And I stood there on the side of it and could look in one direction and see the Lincoln Memorial reflected in the water. This time the sun had gone down and the lights were on. Looking in the other direction, the Lincoln Memorial. Then by stepping over to one corner, I could see reflected in the pool the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, and the Capitol. Then I went up into the Lincoln Memorial and I read those inscriptions on the wall. And I presume never in my life has there come to my heart such a feeling of gratitude and thanksgiving for my citizenship in this land, choice above all others. It's a great blessing to live in America. It's a great blessing to have the opportunity to enjoy the freedoms which are ours today. I have seen people, thousands of them, who have lost the freedom which is ours, where they can no longer meet as we meet here this morning and express themselves as they see fit, where they no longer had freedom of movement, freedom to select their own jobs, their own educational opportunities, freedom to speak their minds, to write what they wished, freedom of enterprise. In many parts of the world today, these rich blessings of freedom no longer exist. I don't know how you feel, my brethren and sisters, but I'd rather be dead than to lose my liberty. I have no fear we'll ever lose it because of invasion from the outside. But I do have fear that it may slip away from us because of our own indifference, our own negligence as citizens of this land. And so I plead with you this morning that you take an active interest in matters pertaining to the future of this country. And if the time should come when you're associated with groups that take delight in tearing down our American way of life, when they seem to enjoy pointing out the weaknesses of our free enterprise system, and it has weaknesses. It has weaknesses because it's operated by men and women who are full of weaknesses. But when those times come, when it's criticized, if you just keep in mind the fruits of the system, the great blessings that have come to us because of our American way of life. No group of people have ever attained the standard of living which is ours. And so let's become acquainted with what has been accomplished. It's all right to criticize. It's all right to try and improve our American way of life. But in doing so, let's not surrender. Let's not give up. Let's not jeopardize that system which has made America great. Just one further thought, and then I won't tire you longer. I have great hope for the youth of Zion. I believe firmly, my brethren and sisters, that there's no group of young people in all the world who have the opportunities which are yours. I believe firmly that in the days ahead, this nation is going to demand and need the leadership of men and women who have been trained in the home, in the church, in the school, like you've been trained. Who have your ideals, who are guided by the principles which guide your lives. You're going to be needed in positions of leadership. Because I'm confident that while the world may not live our standards, in the days ahead they're going to look for men and women to fill positions of trust, who have the courage, the faith, and the good common sense to live according to the teachings and standards of this great church, the only true church upon the face of the whole earth. God's kingdom restored again to bless mankind. And I hope and pray, my brethren and sisters, that as those calls come, we will be true to the great trust imposed in us. And we can only be true to that trust if we're true to the principles and the standards for which this church stands. Because those standards and those ideals are part of the gospel of Jesus Christ. They are true. They are the way of life which the God of heaven has prescribed for His children. At their foundation is spirituality, faith in God, and faith in all that's pure and good and holy and uplifting. God, help us to prepare ourselves for the assignments ahead and to measure up in every particular, guided always by the eternal principles upon which the church and kingdom of God have been established and upon which this nation has been founded and this great institution. As I close, I think of the words of the Apostle Paul as he stood before King Agrippa making his defense. Paul, a persecutor of the saints, converted to Christianity through a glorious manifestation. There, as he stood before King Agrippa in chains, the king permitted him to make his own defense. And I remember that as he made his defense, outlining the mission of Christ, and referring to this thing called Christianity, he said to the king, "Surely, king, you must have heard of this new movement. For," he said, "this thing has not been done in a corner." And how well that applies to Mormonism today. Yes, persecutions have come in the past. Our people have endured much. I think of the prophet in Liberty Jail. I think of the brethren that were shot down by mobs. I think of the missionaries and the persecutions that met them. I think of that great struggle referred to by Brother Wilkinson when Senator Smoot was trying to take his seat in the Senate. The hearings went on for weeks. I went through those hearings a year ago. 4 great volumes of 1,000 pages each of testimony. It was easy to see before you'd read very far, it was not Reed Smoot who was on trial. It was the church and people whom he represented. Our standard works. Private papers of the First Presidency. Confidential items were placed in the record. And finally, the president of the church was placed on the witness stand, not for hours, but for days. And I wonder if the Lord didn't have a hand in it. I sometimes think, too, that one of the reasons why he permitted, yea, directed, some of the early leaders of the church to enter into the sacred relationship of plural marriage was for the purpose of publicizing his people. Men's ways are not God's ways. Maybe it's his way of getting Mormonism before the world. No, this thing has not been done in a corner. The hand of God has been directing his church and his people. And so it will be in the future. And while honors may come to us, conferred by men, and those honors are important, of course they are, but no honor will ever come to any member of this church in the political world that will equal or even approach the honor which comes to a man when he's ordained to a high office in the church and kingdom of God, when he has conferred upon him the holy priesthood, that which is eternal, that which is most priceless. God, help us, my brethren and sisters, to cherish the priceless blessings which are ours through membership in the church, that our testimonies may continue strong, that we may love the priesthood, love the church and all that it stands for, and at the same time, be true Americans, true to our way of life, true to the eternal principles upon which this nation has been established. I humbly pray, thanking you and thanking my Heavenly Father for this privilege of looking into your faces this morning and praying God's blessings to attend you always. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.